The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. It doesn't make sense. It isn't right. It shouldn't be. But housewives in Kansas may find the price of food is directly related to whether or not Arabs in countries they never heard of, such as Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, Qatar, and others, are happy or not. You know, through the era of the Cold War of the 60s, it seemed the leadership in Washington couldn't make a decision without consulting the Kremlin first. Whether it had to do with Vietnam, or whether it had to do with some major domestic problems we might have had, it seemed that leadership in Washington always kept one eye on what was happening inside the Soviet Union and wanted to know what would the Russian reaction be. So everything we did, whether in relation to Cuba, Vietnam, or other international problems specifically, always had to take into consideration what will the Russians think, what will the Russian reaction be. Now today, the United States finds itself, because of dependence upon Arab oil and because of an absolute unwillingness to face a crisis in which we have found ourselves for years, and it's growing worse, not better, but we don't even want to admit that it is a crisis. We want to call it something else. Perhaps in those days when the bearers of bad news were actually beheaded, and that has happened in the past simply because people didn't want to hear bad news, perhaps those days are coming back again. Like the couple I've told you about, George and Martha, rocketing along the freeway at about 75. A lot of people do that today, you know, and regardless of the national 55 speed limit. Martha says, "George, we're about out of gas. We better stop at a service station." He says, "Nonsense, Martha, we're going 75. Don't you wish you'd have bought a big car back when the bottom dropped out? Don't you wish you'd have bought that camper or that motorhome or that RV you wanted when the bottom dropped out? But notice how quickly everything recovered. The prices went crazy for a while. Motorhomes, campers, recreational vehicles, vans, some of the big gas gulpers, the large limos, and the big automobiles that Americans are so accustomed to simply wouldn't move off of any lot. All kinds of rebates were given, all kinds of attractions. Cadillacs could be had for about half of what they were normally worth. But take a look today at what has happened. Americans obviously don't believe there is any such thing as an oil shortage or an energy crisis. They just don't believe it. Big cars are back in fashion. You can cause, perhaps at worst, a rear-ender accident, and at best, an angry line of irritated motorists behind you if you drive down any two-lane highway at 55 miles an hour. On the freeway, you're going to look like you're going backwards. Automobiles will be going by you so rapidly on both sides, you'll probably get out to find out why you stopped. That's at 55. So that is being increasingly ignored. Now, of course, in a presidential year, in an election year, nobody wants to make some issue out of energy. It isn't even entering into the issue. It seems that no one is talking about it one way or the other because no one wants to rock the boat. We want to leave voters in their complacency. Congress doesn't want to challenge that complacency, and so Congress is unwilling to deal really seriously with the problem. Remember how you were lied to by the newspapers who didn't deliberately do it necessarily? They were passing on what government said when they claimed in the early days of the oil embargo and the energy crisis following the Yom Kippur War that we were dependent on Arab oil for about 11%. Well, that wasn't true. We were dependent to a greater degree than that. We were 33% dependent. 33 barrels out of every 100 barrels consumed came from Arab countries. Had to be imported into the United States. Some portion of that perhaps from Venezuela and a few other countries, but the bulk of it from Arab countries. Now for a time there, when people were beginning to ask, is this trip necessary? Should I get a smaller automobile? Should I join some kind of a club? Maybe we ought to walk. Maybe we ought to take the bus. Maybe we ought to ride a bicycle. Americans were canceling trips, vacation resorts were hard hit. A lot of motels and roadside restaurants and facilities were beginning to feel the crunch. You remember what it was like. You probably were thinking seriously about canceling a trip. People were beginning to wonder about buying an old used oil truck and storing black market gasoline in the backyard. People were carrying jerry cans in their trunks and having the highway authorities remind them that if you're rear-ended with one of those things in there, you're liable to end up in a funeral pyre of flames because of trying to carry extra gas in case you ran out on the road. Remember that? Well, you know, the American people began to do a pretty good job. Oh, sure, there were the problems. The long gas line, somebody was threatened with a gun in Brooklyn because he wanted gasoline when the pump was empty. Others were charging up to a dollar a gallon and getting away with it. Remember all of that furor? It wasn't very long ago. But even after all of that and out of it all, the American people were really beginning to adjust. Airlines were laying off crews, canceling flights, putting aircraft in the hangars and on the deck and leaving them there. And everything would have gradually readjusted in a year or two or three, while we would have readjusted to becoming completely independent in our various energy sources. The idea that we would become independent was based on several very ridiculous assumptions. That was the administration, remember? They said, Project Independence. We're going to become absolutely independent. And we can eliminate dependency upon imported fuels by the mid-1980s. But those assumptions were very, very rosy indeed. That included the idea that price controls on domestic oil and gas would be removed, that coal production would probably just about double or even triple. Nuclear power would, of course, come into its own and really be providing millions upon millions of kilowatts of electrical energy, and we would have nuclear power plants all over the country. Oil from shale would become a commercial reality. We saw the maps of so much of the northwestern part of the United States and the Rocky Mountain states of Colorado and Wyoming. And we saw that there underlying those mountains are vast deposits of shale in which there is oil that can be commercially obtainable. Rosy view indeed. We heard about the Alaskan pipeline, offshore exploration, the opening up of additional wells, some of the government like the Navy reserves up near Bakersfield that could be taken out of reserve status. All kinds of interesting things looked like they could happen. We could increase production on existing fields, and we could go into exploration of additional oil and gas fields on the offshore areas, but of course we had the environmental problems and all of that. Conservation efforts, of course, would keep people driving less, flying less, burning less. We would keep the thermostat set at 68 and bundle up in our winter overalls and underwear both, I guess I should say. But that very quickly passed out of vogue, too. As a matter of fact, none of those things happened. Price controls on domestic oil and gas were not removed. Coal production has barely been increased, and very little. Nuclear power is about where it was. Oil from shale is not yet a reality. And conservation efforts, well, those have totally disappeared. So where we were dependent for 33 out of 100 barrels on the Arabs' oil in the beginning of the energy crisis, we are now dependent for 44 out of every 100 barrels on the Arabs. Now you have to realize that the Arab OPEC countries, not all of them are Arabs, when you include, of course, Venezuela and Iran, though Muslim, not Arab, but OPEC countries in the by and large are Arab. Some of the Arab Persian Gulf sheikdoms and others are the leading Arab states. You have to realize now that another Arab oil embargo, say in 1977, could result in such an absolute disastrous shock to the United States economy, which in turn, even though Japan and Western Europe might not be included in such a theoretical embargo, that they too would suffer such staggering shocks as a result of the economic impact in the United States that it would plunge the world far deeper into worldwide recession and possibly even into a Great Depression. Do you know that Arabs right now are holding a scimitar over the jugular of all major developed Western societies, including even Japan? Now, some analysts think that an embargo is unlikely because they think that would be irrational. And they don't think that the Arabs would be irrational. They think it is very unlikely that Arabs would impose another oil embargo because it might hurt their own recovery attempts and economies. That would be like people saying in advance of the Yom Kippur War, they didn't believe that Egypt and Syria would launch another attack against Israel because they might possibly lose. And that could result in billions of loss could further shock their own economies, and maybe the Soviet Union this time around would not be willing to replace some of the lost weapons, and therefore they wouldn't take the gamble because it would be too risky for the Egyptians merely to try to win back some of their lost manhood to prove that Egyptians can go forward instead of in reverse. And so speculators at that time may have said, why, such a move would be irrational. Egypt and Syria would not want to attack Israel now, even if they do have all those weapons, because look what it would do on the domestic scene. They would probably not recover for another 10 years. It would hurt their already terrible flagging economies. They wouldn't do it. Today they're telling us another embargo is unlikely, because it would hurt Arab recovery attempts and economies. But then, maybe a fire in your home is unlikely. And I suppose an automobile accident happening to you today or tomorrow is unlikely. And I suppose it was unlikely what happened in the Big Thompson River there in Colorado. And I suppose those people going to that convention over there thought that it was very unlikely that, who knows from what source, some horrible disease could come along. But does that mean, because it's unlikely, you don't carry automobile insurance? Does that mean, because it's unlikely that you're going to drop dead tomorrow, you don't have life insurance? Does that mean it's unlikely that something could come along to just completely shock the present-day way of things, and so you don't even make any preparations whatsoever? There are Bible prophecies clear back in an ancient, forgotten, dusty book called Daniel that most people have never read in their life that talk about all the money, all the real goodies, the precious things, power, energy, centered around the Middle Eastern area. Last time in the program where I was talking about the Olivet prophecy in Matthew 24 and how Jesus showed that the area around Jerusalem would become absolutely festooned with arms. It would be absolutely the world's greatest stockpile of military weaponry, and I was giving a report that, in fact, that is already happening now. That the most militarized area in the world is the Middle East, the Arab nations, and Israel. That there is a vast arms race underway, fueled by the big arms suppliers of the United States and the Soviet Union. And that in terms of tanks and aircraft, those represent about the same force as you find in the NATO armies of Europe. That the Bible is a Middle Eastern book, that prophecy is Middle Eastern. It looks out at the rest of the world from the viewpoint of Jerusalem, modern-day Israel, formerly called Palestine. Historically, ethnically, racially, politically, especially spiritually, biblically, prophetically, the Bible is a book of the so-called Holy Land. It's a Middle Eastern book. It views the rest of the world from the point of view of the Middle East. And Bible prophecy, primarily, relates to what happens to all the rest of the world in the light of what occurs in the Middle East. The Olivet prophecy of Matthew 24 that talks about a time where we would see wars, rumors of wars, drought, famine, disease epidemics, and huge earthquakes in different and diverse places, leading up to a time called the Great Tribulation. That prophecy also centers in Jerusalem and the Middle East. When Jesus was talking to his disciples, he talked about when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, then know the destruction thereof is nigh. He was talking about an end time destruction, not that which occurred as a type by the armies of Titus way back prior to the end of the first century. He was talking about our day right now, the time in which we live today. Now, in the larger sense, armies already surround Jerusalem, don't they? Because Arab armies in all directions of the compass, except out in the Mediterranean, where there, of course, you find a huge Soviet fleet that now outnumbers the United States, and so you see that that area is absolutely bristling with arms. Now, in this prophecy in the book of Daniel, you will read, if you will turn to the 11th chapter, how the time of the end, and that is a key point to remember, that you are living, whether you like to deny it, ignore it, or not, in a biblically prophesied time of the end. An end time, the consummation at the close of an age and the beginning of a new and a different age that is finally going to come to this world. But it's always darkest just before the dawn, and this world is due for some awful, incredible shocks to its economies, to its governments, to its entire structure of civilization and the social order. It's probably going to begin in trade wars that has been underway in that direction for a long time. You're going to be seeing the emergence of a new power that will rise out of the ashes of a new economic depression inside Europe, You're going to see nations go to militarism, dictatorships, in order to solve some of the horrible problems of present-day governments, which are absolutely unable to solve the incredible problems of runaway inflation, stagnation, or stagflation as it's called, a business recession, and lack of productivity, at the same time with runaway inflation. In this prophecy, in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, one of the longest prophecies in all of the Bible, you read about the time of the end and what's going to happen in the Middle East as a result. It talks about a king of the south, meaning some leader, perhaps a leader over a collection of several nations, but some outstanding leader in the Middle Eastern area of North Africa or the Persian Gulf area, perhaps Saudi Arabia, and there are many kings down there, remember. Even the word Shah means king. He is like a king or an emperor in the nation of Iran. There's King Khalid now of Saudi Arabia, for example. But it talks about a time of the end when the king of the south will push at a king of the north. Now, traditionally, during history, as you can read in some of the Bible reference books on the subject of the Ptolemies, a series of kings, of dynasties, of lesser pharaohs, perhaps, called the Ptolemies of Egypt, and the Seleucids or Seleucidae of Syria, a like dynasty or succession of kings down through many years in the Syrian nation, were waging war one against the other. And historians and interpreters of biblical prophecy or eschatology will see a partial fulfillment or a typical fulfillment in this prophecy. But strangely enough, even in our time, or in the time just before most of us, between World War I and World War II, one of those events which at least helped fuel the beginning of World War II was the attack into Somaliland or Ethiopian Eritrea by the troops of Mussolini's armies prior to the beginning of World War II, where a king of the north, in this case, sent armies aboard ships and with aircraft, and this describes in old biblical language that type of military endeavor. Let's read it in verse 40 of Daniel 11. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him with a whirlwind, or like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. But it goes on to say, and this did not occur in that time, under that typical fulfillment with Mussolini's armies invading into that area. It goes on to say in verse 41, he shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. The glorious land meaning Palestine or modern-day Israel with the city of Jerusalem. And these shall escape Edom, and that means Turkey, Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon, the capital of Jordan is Ammon, and the Moabites and those people are still in the area to the east of the Jordan River where they have always been. He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Now that shows action-reaction. That shows an offensive gesture of some type and retaliation. I have speculated, and I think it's only speculation, it's not necessarily interpretation, that as you view two major things occurring, one, increased dependency of those modern industrialized nations which have to depend for their very life's blood upon the flow of Arab oil, and secondly, the resulting economic wealth of the Arabs as a direct result. So two things are happening. The wealth of the world is absolutely pouring into the Middle East. And oftentimes they don't want paper. They want gold and they want silver. Now we're going to go on and read in this scripture something rather interesting. Here is this king of the north, which actually does represent a yet future alliance or union, amalgamation, some kind of a political federation of some sort, inside Europe, which eventually will become 10 nations. It may grow out of the ashes of the present European Economic Community. It does not necessarily need to include the present members of that community, nor need it grow out of that community. That community could fall apart, fragment, and different organizations emerge, but eventually, in the time in which we live, in the very time that is prophesied in Matthew 24, where the potential for the destruction of human life would be possible, for the beginning overtures, which are certainly going to lead toward a nuclear bomb, World War III, would be daily coloring your news. Then there is going to come the creation of a monstrous military power, 10 nations in all, who will give their total military strength in uncommitted, unreserved form into the hands of one great military leader over all 10 of those nations. He is that king of the north identified in this prophecy of Daniel 11. And he will go into the area of Palestine, including Egypt and surrounding nations. Now, what would cause that reaction? What action brings about that reaction? What overt act is pushing at a nation? Notice the language of the prophecy. He says the king of the south pushes at the king of the north, but the king of the north retaliates like a whirlwind, speedily, swiftly, with the speed of aircraft or missiles, perhaps, and with ships. And it uses the language of horsemen, which in modern parlance would mean armored troops, tanks, etc. It's old biblical language, but you need to understand it in the light of the present way of things today, because it's a prophecy about the end of time. So the pushing at the king of the north is not an overt military attack. It's something else. Now, we live in a time today where the equilibrium of the Western world depends upon happy Arabs. Anything which upsets or unsettles Arab leadership today could result not only in absolutely unacceptable price increases, which in itself would send shuddering reverberations throughout the Western economies and all of the world, but the potential of another embargo, simply cutting the oil off. Now, the stake we have in the area is that the United States has followed the policy of being virtually the sole guarantor of Israel's territorial integrity, Israel's right to exist, Israel's freedom. The Arabs don't like that. They want us to withdraw our support from Israel. They want to be free to try to drive the Israelis into the sea or to exterminate them. Characters on the world scene, such as, what does he call himself? I think he calls himself the Herr Doctor, Most High, Greatly Respected, Chief Mucky Muck, Big Daddy, His Imperial Excellency, His Royal Highness, or whatever it is, all kinds of things he calls himself. Big Daddy Amin, down there in Uganda. One of the most gigantic bags of empty hot air you've ever seen in your entire life. But this idiotic despot would like to pursue the policy of the absolute extermination of the people of Israel, who actually helped him build his little country. You ought to read the book about 90 Minutes in Uganda, or in Entebbe, which is out right now, which they got out very speedily as a result of that fantastic rescue of the people who were aboard that hijacked Air France aircraft. It shows you what some of the backdrop behind Amin's Air Force and his airport really was, and that some of his closest, most trusted friends were in the nation of Israel, and that for a long time there, even prior to the UN resolution which finally designated Israel as the Jewish homeland, did you know that Uganda was the second territorial area in the entire world where the Jews of Europe thought they might be able to create a homeland? Surprising, but very true. They had very close ties. But this character, Amin, decided that his real fortunes lay with the Muslim Arab bloc and the third world developing countries, and of course he wants to be grandstanding on the world scene, swaggering around a lot of medals I guess he got from the Battle of the Okavango Swamp, or the Battle of the Retreating Elephants, or the Battle of the Braying Hyenas. I don't know what wars he's been in or what he fought, but he sure got a chest full of fruit salad to prove how valorous he is. So, at the present rate, with the emergence of nations such as that are calling for the virtual extermination of the Israelis realize that if the United States ever should withdraw its support, they may just actually have to rely on their arsenal of nuclear weapons, which I happen to believe they have. You need to realize then that the Middle East is an absolute tinder keg of potential for violence which could plunge the entirety of the world into World War III. But in this prophecy of the 11th chapter of Daniel, where it shows not a military overt act, not an attack, but a pushing at, then you realize that the wealth of the world is poured into the Middle East, and you realize that the oil that is the life's blood of Europe, Japan, and to a larger and larger extent now, 44%, even of the United States, of dependency upon fueling our economies. The wheels go round, the automobiles and the aircraft go, your kitchen appliances probably come on, your lights oftentimes are burning because Arab oil is fueling an energy source. Down the line, downstream somewhere, maybe out there in the desert, maybe somewhere nearby, there's a giant steam-generated plant, but the oil that is fueling the burners has come from maybe Kuwait or Abu Dhabi. So you have to realize that this pushing at could be a combination of either unacceptable price increases or a new oil embargo, or it could even be an economic move. What about a world gold standard, rejection of the dollar as a reserve currency? For example, Now, the British have been told that the Arabs don't want their pounds anymore. They want silver. Look at this scripture. It says when this king of the north reacts to this push from these Arab bloc countries, that he will stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps, showing that he goes all the way to Egypt with the borders of Libya, Ethiopia. But really, the word Libya is poorly translated, and it means put, P-U-T. And those people actually are the Indian people of Pakistan and today's India. So the borders beyond which these forces do not go actually have to do with the borders of India and Pakistan, showing that the armies of the northern power will flow all the way into the Middle East, the Persian Gulf sheikdoms, including Saudi Arabia. And then it says, tidings out of the east and the north shall trouble him. That's going to be a Soviet and a Chinese reaction, and possibly a Japanese reaction, to an invasion into the Middle Eastern area by a European combined force. And that's going to set the stage for a gigantic battle that is finally called in the Bible the Battle of Armageddon. Well, these prophecies are leaping to life in today's headlines, is the point you need to understand. And it seems as if Americans are going gaily along, absolutely unaware that there is an energy crisis, but it is absolutely with us, and it's inevitable that it's going to grow worse. And it's about time we, not only as a government, but as a people, begin to prepare for it. At least some people are saying that the United States government ought to begin getting busy to build up oil reserves so we could withstand at least a six-month Arab oil embargo. You better get ready for a 7 years embargo, perhaps. But do you know how long it would take us to build up a six-month reserve at present rates of import levels and production, where production of U.S. domestic fields is falling off, and because of price controls, the gas companies are saying they don't have the money for new exploration? It would take until 1982. And we don't have that much time. Offshore development is behind schedule. It'll be several years before production increases can be expected. And onshore fields, well, production is falling. I think the one magazine that I know of that can give you the overview of all of these happenings and really put you where it's at on world conditions is called The Plain Truth. I'd like to send it to you by return mail free of charge, and also this booklet on how to understand prophecy, and that booklet I announced yesterday on the black horse of Revelation, which is the booklet on famine. Remember the booklet on famine? Christ predicted it. It's with us today. The booklet on how to understand prophecy and The Plain Truth magazine. You can tell the operator the booklets I mentioned. She'll know exactly which ones you're talking about if you'll dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, for your free copies. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.